Welcome, welcome from Alpha, to Omega.
Hello, and welcome to the 85th episode of From Alpha to Omega. Today is Sunday, the 17th of June, 2018, and I'm your host, Tom O'Brien. This week, we welcome back to the show Professor Andrew Kleiman to talk about the Communist Manifesto. This is part one of a two-part interview on the topic. I have the new monthly subscriber, Devin G, to thank, along, of course, with all the existing and loyal monthly subscribers. You can donate to help to keep the show going by hitting on that there PayPal button or signing up over on Patreon. If you want to leave a comment, please do it on the YouTube channel. And if you are a YouTube listener, please, please, please hit that subscribe button and give the episode a thumbs up. It will undeniably usher in the ultimate utopian communist revolution. Sorry for the low output of episodes recently. I have three more episodes in the bank and ready to go over the next few weeks, so stay tuned. I will also be making an appearance on the Swampside Chats podcast, which is available on SoundCloud and iTunes, to talk about MMT, The Law of Value, and Star Trek. Check it out. Swampside Chats is the best commie podcast out there. Now, to the interview. Okay, Andrew, so you were up last night reading the Communist Manifesto. Can you describe a bit of the milieu of the times when Marx was writing this work?
I don't quite know. What I do know is that he was at that time, and really throughout his life, once he gets kicked out of Germany, you know, he was part of these dissident left emigre communities, and they had all kinds of ideological differences among themselves, and so he was part of this group that had decided to move over to his kind of politics, which was open instead of having secret societies, was proletarian-oriented, you know, interested in the proletarian revolution. And so this was the manifesto, you know, of that. They called it a party, but they don't mean party like we mean party nowadays. There were no political parties in the modern sense back then. What we would call it nowadays is a political current or tendency. You know, things were very bad for workers, and there were revolutions very shortly after this document was published. And the document anticipated this.
How come it's come to have such a big place in Marx's work? Like, it's probably nearly even more famous than Capital, which is his life's work, for such a short document.
Well, I think part of it is that it is so short. In other words, if people read something by Marx, what is it that they read? You know, I don't know.
Not volume two.
How many people read Capital? Eight people? Right, but so if you think of like where people read Capital, where people read Marx, they read it in college. They have some professor who signs something. What do the professors assign? They assign the Communist Manifesto. Why? Because, you know, you're teaching, well, you know, one session or two sessions, you know, on Marx. You couldn't say read, you know, even volume one of Capital, much less three volumes of Capital. And it'd be hard for people to understand, and it's detailed. Here you get a lot of ideas, and they're presented in a punchy fashion. And there are a lot of his ideas packed into this document. So it's easy to discuss, relatively speaking.
Like, I was surprised. Well, just as you said, it's very punchy. It really is. I found it extremely well written, full of quite a few famous lines. Definitely the opening line is very famous. But it also, I found, when you say it was quite condensed, there's a lot in there. I found that if I hadn't read Capital, I think a lot of it would have been kind of confusing, the terminology of surplus and exploitation and the technical senses in which Marx means them. I think it makes the document quite difficult in places.
Oh, for sure. But compared to other things that he wrote, it's not. Okay, so a lot of what we say Marx wrote, he never prepared for publication. But even things that he prepared for publication, he rewrote with how this is going to be read in mind. This is much more accessible than something like The Poverty of Philosophy, which was also, some economic theory, but with an explicit political focus. And that was written, a year earlier. So it's of the same time. This is much easier than the manifesto is. It's much easier than The Poverty of Philosophy.
You know, at this stage when he was writing it, did Marx have his theories of capitalism sorted? It feels like it was largely there.
Well, there's a lot of stuff that's not there, for sure. And there are things he reverses himself on. By the time he writes Capital, there is still a strong sense that the standard of living of the working class is going to decline. There's a strong sense of that in the Communist Manifesto. By the time he writes Capital, you don't get that. You do get changes of views. There's that kind of 10-point program, I guess we would call it, at the end of section two. You know, here are immediate measures. Right after the Paris Commune, he and Engels wrote an introduction or preface to the Communist Manifesto, and they said, look, first of all, we said way back when, that the measures depend on time and place, what needs to be done. And so for that reason, don't put any special emphasis on those measures. But second of all, we've learned from experience. We've learned above all from the Paris Commune that the proletariat cannot, lay hold of The proletariat cannot. He quotes the Civil War in France, which he wrote the previous year. This is the 1872 German edition, the introduction to it or preface. One thing especially was proved by the Commune, namely that, quote, the working class cannot simply lay hold of the ready-made state machinery and wield it for its own purposes. But instead, the state machinery needs to be broken. He changed his mind to a large degree, either that or he kind of thought it was outdated what they had written in 48. He says that passage would, quoting just before, that passage would in many respects be very differently worded today. This program has in some details been rendered antiquated. So he's saying it's antiquated what they were saying there. So yeah, there's a lot of things that were there in the manifesto that, continue. There's some things clearly that were not worked out by that time, and there's some changes of views around the edges. When Marx died, Engels gave a eulogy. I think I'm getting this right. This is from memory. My memory is playing tricks on me, but I think I got this right. And Engels said, look, the theory of historical materialism or the historical materialist perspective, that is due to Marx. It's not due to the both of us. That was Marx alone, and he had it fully worked out in 1844 when he and Engels first met. So the manifesto is 3.5-4 years later.
So if we look at the manifesto, then what would we say was its main conclusions from it? I know that's a very difficult thing to say because there's quite a lot going on in it. But he makes the case for a revolutionary communism.
Right. I think that there's something more specific going on. So you have this political current or tendency, and they're different from other left-wing tendencies, even revolutionary ones. And they call themselves the communists. And what he was at pains to do was say, what is the uniqueness? What is the special character of our perspectives? What are we for in particular vis-a-vis these other groups? So you get, this rather long section comparing their views and how they organize and so forth to the others. So what stands out for me is actually proletarian revolution. So not just revolution, but proletarian revolution and internationalism. The internationalism of this movement is all pervasive. You know, of course, concluding with very famous concluding lines. You know, working men or, you know, of all countries unite. You know, I think that's extremely important for understanding his perspective. It's very important nowadays. You know, when we're faced with this right-wing nationalism and attempts by some people who think they're on the left to accommodate that, it's really important to reclaim this internationalist focus and perspective for the future, in my view. So, yeah, so, I mean, it's a revolutionary document for sure. But I think that to really understand what's going on in the document as a whole, you need to think more specifically about the Communist League. This was they called themselves the Communist Party, but it was the Communist League that was the new organization. You know, where they stood vis-a-vis other kinds of tendencies.
What is it about the system that Marx saw, about capitalism, that made him a revolutionary and not really a reformist?
Oh, I doubt that there's anything to see that makes you like that. You know, I think he drew theoretical conclusions. Not because his personal experience or knowledge of existing conditions was different from others. He just didn't think that capitalism was going to be fundamentally reformable. That's a theoretical perspective based on understanding of history. But again, the key thing was to understand the revolutionary aspect. You have to understand that there were a lot of people trying to bring about social change by means of appealing to the middle class, making deals with, you know, the rulers, and that was antithetical to Marx, because his idea of the change was so deep. The change he wanted and the changes that he thought were needed. And he basically had the view that the people, you know, who do the work, make up the large body of society, they should be running their own lives. They should be free, you know, so that the liberation should not be coming to them as a gift from another's, they need to free themselves. This was a very deeply rooted part of Marx's whole thinking, was human development and this idea of, you know, people liberating themselves was fundamental to it. I don't know, is that a sufficient answer, or is that clearer?
Well, I suppose one of the things I've been thinking about a lot is about how come Marx was so adamant that the proletariat would be so revolutionary, say, as opposed to the peasantry of the times beforehand, and why he thought that it would be such a fundamental difference between those two, say, downtrodden classes.
To understand that, I think, first of all, we did not have although he talks about, you know, modern communications, putting everybody in contact. I mean, now that's like all over the world, even in the most remote places. That did not exist in Marx's time. You know, that was a tendency that he saw coming, you know, and it was starting to happen. But, you know, if you're thinking about having what we now call socialism in modern conditions in the industrialized West, which was at that time limited to parts of Western Europe and maybe the United States, you have to have an urban focus, if that's what you're thinking of. And that's what he was thinking of back then. You know, things changed a good deal later as capitalism developed and as he learned more about non-Western peoples and so forth. But I think part of the answer goes to what you mean by a revolution. I mean, for Marx, a revolution is not just like different people taking over. You know, it's that's the same old thing, you know. What is it? You know, the new cop, same as the old cop, whatever the phrase is. You know, that's not what he meant. So, I mean, the question is, who could really fundamentally change the nature of the society such that it would be production in the interest of the advanced of the immense majority? It's not that hard when you have that perspective, as against it's just like who's going to like rise up. You know, you have a question of what comes after that. If it's more than a question of rise up, it's like who is really going to change the conditions, or who's interested in really changing the social condition? It was clear to Marx. I think it's still pretty obvious that that's the working class under capitalism.
Okay, but I suppose what I'm trying to get at as well is he was seeing the large groups of workers working together in large factories and large foundries and things and stuff like this together in large numbers, and he thought that was a part of a new dynamic. They weren't scattered peasants working on their own land through the country, that this clumping of, say, proletarians, you know, the lower classes together in large numbers, that dynamic alone could, to those the lower classes, say, essentially realizing their strength when they could see that they could go on strike and shut down large operations, that this was itself a component in his thinking about why the proletarian was more revolutionary, say, than the peasantry that were more dispersed.
Well, the dispersal, you know, the people living and working in large numbers is an issue, and I was relating to that when I talked about, you know, the modern means of communication and so forth. What we now think of is like everybody being connected. That didn't used to exist. As for the rest of it, I'm not aware of him saying things like what you said. What we have in Capital, I didn't see it in the manifesto that I recall, but I don't remember things about, you know, strikes. What we have in Capital is that Marx says at the end is that the proletariat is united, organized, and disciplined by the very mechanism of capitalist production itself. So that's something along the lines of what you're saying, but I don't see it in the manifesto. And
like, maybe I'm reading into it. Maybe it's from reading lots of different stuff that was how that was a part of my understanding of why he thought it was just one of those tendencies in Capital for grouping people together like that. You know,
very, very definitely. But it's not so much a matter of large workplaces as such. In other words, in a lot of countries now, you know, like the United States, you don't tend to have, you know, big steel mills, big auto factories where you got the 30,000 people working. You got that in China in a big way. So you have somewhat less than that, but you still have the urbanization. You still have people coming together through modern communications. So some of the problems that he was confronting in terms of carrying out an internationalist perspective, some of those problems we don't have anymore in terms of communication. So there's the issue of you know, the unity and the discipline and the organization that come from the process of production itself. I think the gathering of large numbers of people in urban areas or even nowadays suburbs, I think that mattered a lot, and that was the basis for the factory, large-scale factories is getting people living together. But this idea of like learning through workplace strikes as such, that's... I wouldn't say it's not there, but I don't think Marx focused on that as such.
To me, like, one of the big reasons why I really like Capital Volume 1, 2, and 3 is how kind of it's a description of the current system, say, you know, and it's a description of how it works, and it gives us deep understanding and scientific work. When we get to the Communist Manifesto, does Marx make hard and fast predictions in the manifesto?
There are a couple of things that I would say around the edges that are hard and fast predictions. In the main, I think he's seeing tendencies and inferring that, you know, the tendencies will play out without being impeded or they'll tend to work out a certain way. There's one place where he says that the downfall of the bourgeoisie and the victory of the proletariat is inevitable. And it's hard to know what is meant by inevitable there. I mean, what if a meteor, you know, destroyed the earth? I mean, that's a possibility, right? So was he unaware of that, or does inevitable not include such things? So it's hard. It's just hard to know what he meant by that. And I'm not even sure that he, you know, that the way the term was regularly used, I'm not even certain that the modern connotations we give it were in effect back then. So I have some like questions in my mind about that one bit. But I think that he's looking at tendencies and saying, you know, this is what I think is likely to happen. But hard and fast predictions in the main, no.
Like, that's one of the classic kind of criticisms of the manifesto, is that, like, you know, well, maybe Capital, he's got it right, but in the manifesto, he made the proletariat is going to be revolutionary and we're going to push away through capitalism and it's going to happen in Germany first and blah, 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 blah. And a lot of these predictions kind of semi-happened, didn't work out the way that Marx said it would in the manifesto.
Well, I mean, there were revolutions in 1848 and 49, right after they published this. And so they weren't wrong about that. You know, the revolutions were crushed, they were suppressed, there was a reaction. So they were overly sanguine at that time about the prospects for quick and immediate success. I have no doubt that Marx changed his mind about that shortly thereafter, because I just happened to reread the address to the Central Committee of the Communist League, where this was 1850, and he says, you know, we have to make the revolution permanent, and it might, you know, be 30, 40, 50 years till the proletariat has gained the experience and stuff, throw off basically all of the middle class and bourgeois allies that it momentarily has against specifically the not the class as a whole, but specifically I can't remember the word. But basically, you know, the kings and stuff.
Oh, the feudal lords or whatever.
No. This is absolutist rule. That's what I was
going to say. Okay, absolutist. Okay, yeah. Very good.
Yeah, absolutist rule. So there was a reaction after the 1848-49 revolutions, and there was, a move back towards absolutism. And so, you had most of the liberals, we would call them now, and such, capitulating to that. There were some elements that did not. But they weren't proletarian elements. They weren't in favor of proletarian revolution and so forth. So Marx says, look, these people are temporarily our allies, but they're going to sell out the proletariat the moment they get, the first chance they get. And the proletariat has got to, be very wary of this and just say, okay, we'll fight alongside whoever right now, but we have our own aims and we have to be independent. And so, what we're doing now immediately is not the be-all and end-all. The revolution, the perspective has to be the revolution in permanence, continuing, uninterrupted revolution until we get to the new society. And, he's thinking of a very prolonged process. This is by 1850. Prolonged, 30, 40, 50 years is, I think, where the time frame he was thinking of then. 30, 40, 50 years.
Do you think that the proletariat has ever been really the revolutionary class in history so far? This is a criticism people have, that a lot of the time, that say like in the Russian Revolution, was the proletariat very revolutionary?
Yeah, the proletariat was revolutionary in the Russian Revolution, the February Revolution, the October Revolution, the 1905 Revolution that preceded that. The people forget the proletariat was revolutionary in 1871 in Paris. The proletariat, by its nature, is revolutionary.
Why do you say that?
Because the interests of working people is fundamentally opposed to that of capitalism. If they are going to gain freedom, this is the key point. If they are going to gain freedom, it is not by making changes to the society, but by means of a different society. That is what makes the proletariat revolutionary. Okay, that and it experiences oppression and rebels against that oppression, and exploitation and domination and all of that. So people want to be free. That's the starting point of everything here. And the proletariat cannot gain its freedom by being led by others, by making certain modifications to the existing society, by becoming a new ruling class, any of that stuff. The only way that the proletariat can gain freedom is by means of a wholly new, the destruction of the old society, the creation of a new society in which there are no classes, in which, we don't have capitalism and its, production of so-called value and so forth and so on. So there is something about the proletariat and something about the creation of modern conditions of production that really moves toward a whole new society. And that's the revolution.
So we look at back Marx's time and early 20th century, we had a lot of organized proletarians. How do you look at the state of the proletarian today as a revolutionary class?
Well, they're really under the gun in a lot of ways. And one thing that Marx really did not anticipate was the extent to which, so to speak, the counter-revolution would move into the revolution and co-opt it and disorganize it and cripple it.
What do you mean by that?
Well, we had Stalinism, first of all, which has dealt an immense blow to the working class. that we're still, you know, recovering from. I don't even know if we're recovering. But then you've got these so-called representative, you know, social democratic and similar parties that basically blunt and impede proletarian organization and self-development and independence. And you've got the trade union bureaucracy with which those parties are often allied, and they've done the same thing in a very big way, impede, blunt, disorganized working people in the sense of the, in Marx's day, what he was putting forward was a perspective of, you know, independent working class self-activity, and nowadays we don't even think of that in the main. You know, we see signs of it everywhere breaking out, and then those people come in, you know, at the snap of a fingers, and they're there to co-opt, they're there to take over. So this is a huge problem. And this is, I think this is the main reason why we don't see more working class activity that seems revolutionary. It doesn't have time to develop in a revolutionary direction, you know, before the organizations get taken over, they get co-opted, you know, the leaders get bought off, and so forth and so on. You know, there is something really important to be said for people whose way of life impels them in a revolutionary and in an intransigent direction. I mean, that's among the things that Marx saw about the proletariat. It cannot free itself within the society. The society is built on the unfreedom of the, you know, the worker for capitalism. You get rid of that, you get rid of capitalism. So they're impelled toward the new society. Without that objective relationship, it's very easy to go off in all kinds of directions. I mean, you have to understand, you know, 1848, and they call this the Manifesto of the Communist Party. And we think of that in terms of modern political parties. You know, no, there were no modern political parties. You know, they came later. You know, really, one of the first major ones was the Social Democratic Party, founded through a unification in 1875 in Gotha. And you know, they designed this Gotha program, and some of these people called themselves, you know, Marxist, or they were thought to be, you know, the followers of Marx. And Marx said, look, I'm going to have nothing to do with this program, and I oppose this unification for this, that, and the other reasons. And, you know, so he wrote to us another short document, but that was not for publication. That was so-called marginal notes, and it's much more difficult. That's the critique of the Gotha program. Okay, but that was you know, close to three decades later. You know, that's really the beginning of the political parties that we know, and this institutionalization of things that supposedly are representing the working class instead of being working class.
So, getting back to, you said earlier that Marx had changed his ideas by the 1880s, that he no longer thought that capitalism would lead to the immiseration of the proletariat. I assume this comes from,
right, that was already there by the early mid 60s, if not before. Okay, I mean, you look at volume 1 of Capital, where he's got part 7 on the process of capitalist accumulation. There was no sense of that there.
So, and like,
nothing in the sense of worsening of the standard of living. You get a lot of stuff that is, you know, very highly critical. And he says, the lot of the worker must grow worse. But what precedes the phrase, the lot of the worker must grow worse, is be his payment high or low, the lot of the worker must grow worse. So if you look even further forward in the same paragraph, or maybe the paragraph before, he's talking about the whole of the worker's lifetime being, you know, sucked away by working, you know, turned into labor time, the drawing of the kids and the wife, I think he uses that expression, being drawn in into production, you know, female labor, child labor, the horrible alienation and just terrible working conditions and so forth and so on. He does not have a decline in the material standard of living in mind when he's saying this. So he says, irrespective of that, be his payment high or low, the lot of the worker must grow worse. He's referring to all those other things.
Well, like we have seen that the workplace has, in the West anyway, has probably improved, you know, health and safety and stuff like that. Did Marx think that would not happen?
Did Marx think that what would not happen?
Well, sorry, let me
the improvements
be clear.
The improvements to workplace conditions?
Yeah, like it seems to imply what you're, I'm just like, does what you're quoting there seem to say the opposite of what has happened in the workplace with health and safety?
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, I think one thing we have to come to grips with is a shift in the location of capitalist production, not from one place to another, but in terms of shares of production with the globalization of capital. So much of production now, capitalist production, takes place in the third world. From what I know, conditions are terrible there, and their workplace conditions are, you know, they're not great elsewhere. There are laws, but in the United States, the enforcement of those laws is a joke. There have been continual battles, even in, you know, in the United States, against speed up, against all kinds of conditions, all kinds of wildcat strikes that, you know, people would not hear about. I don't know if you've got that term in
yeah,
Britain.
We do, yeah. No, it's interesting, because what I'm trying to get at is here is that, like, if Marx was at the time of writing the Communist Manifesto, if he has since moved away from that kind of immiseration of the proletariat, you know, it seems to me that would have an impact on the revolutionary nature of the proletariat as a class.
It would, if it were a big enough issue, such that, you know, people could work for 20 years and then have saved up enough to live a comfortable life without working. You know, that would free them from subordination to capital. But that's not what happens. You know, what happens is people have a TV and a cell phone, maybe a smartphone, you know, and they've got a couch. That doesn't change your life immensely. You know, the reality is you still have to get up every day and go to work whether you want to or not. And you're producing something that you have no interest in. You're working under conditions that you have no say in. You're doing the bidding of, you know, other people, you know, for a motive that's not yours. That's a really big deal.
Oh, no, I totally do. But, like, you know, if we look at, say, the Arab Spring revolutions that happened, which were, you know, whatever we want to call them. But, you know, one of the big predictors for which countries had a revolution was, you know, the price of food, price of bread and things like these went up, you know, double, triple in price for a while. And it really took away from the labor power, reduced the labor power, if you want to put it that way, of the working class. But, you know, and you know, that kind of immiseration tendency in those Arab countries, you know, led to revolutionary behavior. I'm just wondering, like, is just trying to interrogate how Marx's thinking about revolution changed with his changes in thinking about immiseration.
Oh, I thought you were asking me my view. You know, I'm me, and Marx is Marx, and obviously I'm not him.
Or even your view, Andrew, as well. You know, like, you know, I'm just trying to.
Right. I mean, my view is what I shared with you. I don't disagree with what you said about Arab Spring and riots over you know, or rebellions over rising prices of staple goods and so forth. I don't disagree with that. But you know, there are still, even with the higher living standards, you know, people are still exploited and oppressed and so forth. And this is their whole life, their whole life, you know, and you can't really reasonably escape this, except in, you know, very rare and exceptional circumstances. There are exceptions. But in the main, as a class, the working class does not escape this. Did this have any effect on Marx's thinking? I mean, he said, look, the best thing for the proletariat is to have, you know, booming industry, boom conditions rather than bust conditions. Did this affect, like, his view of whether the proletariat was a revolutionary class? Not that I can see. I'm kind of, like, trying to think. I can't come across, you know, in my brain, in my memory, I can't. There's nothing that I can see that would lead in that direction, to that conclusion.
So I suppose what I'm trying to build out the idea here about the revolutionary nature of the proletariat class. Like, it seems to me that if ever there was to be a communist revolution that was successful, it has to be led by the proletariat. Our problem as, say, radical Marxists or whatever is, how the hell do you get there? Are we going to be reliant on, like, this kind of immiseration to be the spark that could lead to it? How many communist revolutions were there where things were quite well run at the time? You know, usually they seem to be closely linked to economic crises and war conditions.
Yeah, I mean, that is for sure. People had wrong theories. They weren't thinking about things in the right way. There's been substitution of the idea of a political takeover for a real revolutionary transformation of social and economic conditions. There's a lot of things like that. But let me just say a word about this word, miserization or miseration. Marx uses that term in Capital. So he doesn't give up that word. You know, or, you know, increasing misery is the way it's often translated. Okay? So, you know, if people come away and say, Kleinman says that Marx, you know, gave that up and ha ha ha, it's here. Yeah, it's there, but he's not referring to a reduction in standard of living. He's referring to
a more general sense of immiseration, say.
Yeah, the misery of one's life working for capital. You know, and the whole family being brought in, and the work, which is, you know, the working conditions are terrible, and all of those things that he talks about before he says a lot of the worker must grow worse via payment higher or low. Okay, that's what
Yeah, I suppose it's quite interesting.
That to him is what he's referring to as misery. Yeah,
like, as in, if you talk to, say, somebody who's working today, you know, I think there's a lot of analysis out there about, like, you know, the number of friends that people have nowadays is reduced. The amount of social interaction people have nowadays is reduced. How closely people know the people in their neighborhood and trust them is reduced. And we're getting more and more isolated. Like, that would be termed as a part of the immiseration of capital.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, everything in the society has something to do with capital one way or another. Is the question in my mind is this a necessary tendency of capitalism, you know, or is it just something that has occurred within capitalism and, you know, given various anarchic features of capitalist society, they've done nothing to stop it from happening, and they might be powerless to stop it from happening. I mean, it seems that, you know, social media and the internet have a lot to do with the kinds of trends that you're talking about. You know, so they arose because of capitalism and, you know, the profits and so forth, for, you know, having a new app or whatever it might be, and Facebook and all of that. So they arose,
you know, even television, or, you know,
yeah, like, right. So these things arise within capitalism, and the capitalist class has its eye on something better than, you know, something different than bettering people's conditions. So they don't care about this fundamentally. So And they don't stop it. Also, we don't know if they have the power to stop it. There's a lot of things that they create that they might not want, but they don't have the power to stop. Because, you know, there's a social system there. It's not just like decisions of people. But, you know, is this just something that happened, a historical contingency that could have gone a different way? I just don't know.
It does seem to be like in Capital that they have, like, certainly when they have choices in development, they go for ones that are more atomizing over ones that are more social, like the design of houses, of neighborhoods, of streets, of you name it.
I don't know. I can think of exceptions. I think of company towns in the coal mining regions. I think of, Foxconn? I think it's officially Taiwanese. You know, but they're there in China and they have 470, maybe they've downsized now, but they had over 400,000 people working in one place. You know, and they're all congregated there in company housing, and so they're all brought together. I mean, this was not a question of like, okay, let's build tract homes for these people so that they'll all have their little plot of land and think of themselves as an owner. That was not definitely what was going on there.
We'll just put them in dormitories, it's like my boarding school.
Yeah, I mean, they were living basically in dormitory conditions. I think they were even sharing beds.
Even worse.
You know, people on this shift are working here, you get to sleep, and you know, when their shift is over, you'll be working and they use the same bed. I think I don't quite remember, but I think I read that.
So it sounds like living on a submarine. On this episode, you heard the theme tune, The Order of the Pharaonic Jesters, by Sun Ra and his orchestra. Thank you for listening, and please join me for the next episode of From Alpha to Omega.